This episode of The Partially Examined Life is brought to you by Warby Parker. Get boutique-quality, stylish eyewear and sunglasses at revolutionary prices. Try them for yourself by going to warbyparker.com/PEL and ordering your free home try-on kit with free shipping all around.
The Partially Examined Life depends on your support. To find out how to do that in ways that are cheap or even free, go to partiallyexaminedlife.com/support.
You are listening to The Partially Examined Life, a philosophy podcast by some guys who at one point set on doing philosophy for a living, but then thought better of it. Our question for episode 146 is something like, what is our place in the universe, or maybe what is time to us? And we read Emmanuel Levinas's Time and the Other from 1948. This is a follow-up on our episode 145, where we started with a little bit of that, plus some other things by Levinas. This is Mark Lintzenmeyer, enchained with self in Madison, Wisconsin.
This is Wes Allwyn, ruptured from the anonymous vigilance of the There Is in Boston, Massachusetts.
Wow. This is Seth Paskin, hypostasized to freedom in Austin, Texas.
This is a continuation from last time where we supposedly covered the last half of this, but we actually didn't get around to it at all. We only had the last half because it was part of the Levinas reader, but taking this as a whole from the beginning, where it almost gives his own version of Hegel's phenomenology very fast with its own agenda, is way better.
Way better than what?
Than the thing we led for last time, I thought, or merely reading the second half of this. Were you not as enchanted?
I enjoyed this a lot. I enjoyed the other reading too.
I really liked it, but again, I was planning on writing my dissertation in part on this guy. And so it's been a pleasure for me to revisit and rediscover. I can say that this book, as compared to Totality and Infinity, which is kind of one of his giant masterworks, at least in this translation, is extremely readable and very enjoyable. And his line of reasoning is just very rigorous and very linear. So it's very easy to follow. It's a difficult subject and a difficult argument, but he doesn't make the argument any more difficult by the way he structures it. And I think the language is appropriate to the subject too. So I was very pleased to read it.
I was more convinced that that Ethics is First Philosophy essay that we read last time probably was actually written later after Totality and Infinity in 1984 when it was published. We were just guessing at that last time because of the difference in style. So this time we got the whole book of Time and the Other, which again was based on lectures from 1946 to 47, published in 1948. However, there is a preface from 1979 that he wrote himself, and I found it really unhelpful.
Yes, I didn't read the preface.
It was super obscure. He describes what is the main project of this. Why is he letting it still be republished? He says the main project, which he still supports, is answering the question, is time the very limitation of finite being, or is it the relationship from finite being to God? Which has no relation.
Yeah, well, insofar as the preface is unhelpful, don't you think the translator's introduction was helpful?
Yes, yes.
I didn't read that either.
Oh, really?
It was a good secondary source. It set up what this essay was.
And places it in the context of the broader stream of his thought. And I mean, really, it was really good. Maybe next time when we circle back around on this, Wes, you can read it. But you know, Mark, what this puts me in mind of, how many times have we read something that were lectures that were transcribed and said, oh my God, if only so-and-so had written their masterwork in this style, it would have been so much. Why do philosophers even write books? Why don't they just give lectures and record them? Because apparently the obligation of having to be understood by an audience that is immediately present, perhaps even looking them in the face, is somehow compels philosophers to be more articulate and to the point than they are otherwise.
I think this was also an attempt, though, to stare in the face, not only of the listeners, but of Heidegger, of looking that man in the face and realizing
how many different
complete otherness.
Ways can we use the face-to-face metaphor? let's see during the course of the podcast.
Looking at the ass of Heidegger. He's following Heidegger.
Cheek to cheek.
That's what I'm saying, yes. And if he didn't like some notion in Heidegger, he would turn the other cheek of Heidegger's ass. Okay.
All right, so what's motivating him with all of this? Do you guys seem to have more of the background from the intro, and you did some extra reading in Heidegger. What's he up against?
Well, the motivation, the overall motivation, I think in the last podcast, we already described pretty well, which is to ground ethics. But the way in which he does this here, we didn't really get into so much what does phenomenology amount to for him. We said, well, he follows Heidegger. He was very influenced by Husserl, but he follows Heidegger in thinking that you can't just sit back and examine the contents of your consciousness in the manner of Descartes and Husserl's Cartesian meditations, because the thing at issue is very much what constitutes the relationship of self and the world. And so if you sit back and are observing the world, well, you're already putting yourself in a frame of mind that is very much going to determine the kind of thing you find. That what Heidegger and Levinas following him want to do is find things that are more primordial than phenomenological experience could unearth.
Really? They want to find something more primordial than that they can unearth, or to follow their path and try to be more true to what it's actually showing? Or, well, I don't know. I'm kind of two minds about this.
I think it's both, because I think you want to be a good phenomenologist, but then a couple of places he says, and now we're going beyond phenomenology.
Yes, you have to begin with phenomenology, but there's a point at which you have to recognize the limits of the phenomenological method.
Well, let's say what he says about it. It's right at the beginning, right, where he makes this remark about phenomenology.
Yeah.
I did not remember such a remark near the beginning there. He says that he's going to give a dialectic of being. He's not going to do it like Hegel meant to do it. Dialectic means that you're sort of looking at the internal tensions and then there's a movement to the opposite. He's just trying to find the place of the subject in the economy of being.
Yes.
He says.
All right. Are we ready for a little bit of reading to kind of set the stage?
Sure.
Page 39. The aim of these lectures is to show that time is not the achievement of an isolated and lone subject, but that it is the very relationship of the subject with the other. To uphold this thesis, it will be necessary, on the one hand, to deepen the notion of solitude, and on the other, to consider the opportunities that time offers to solitude. The analysis I am about to undertake will not be anthropological, but ontological. I want to present solitude as a category of being, to show its place in a dialectic of being, or rather, because the word dialectic has a more determinate meaning, to show the place of solitude in the general economy of being. Thus, from the start, I repudiate the Heideggerian conception that views solitude in the midst of a prior relationship with the other.
Right. So I just actually re-listened to our Heidegger's Being and Time episode. And yes, we are in the mode of being with others. That is part of our primary, you know, what we are as Dasein. And so if we're by ourselves, if we happen to be stranded on an island, well, that is a deficient form of being with others. But we are still the kind of creatures who are being with others, you know, unless you actually never interacted with anybody since your birth. Well, okay, you would not be a human being. You would not be Dasein, even if you somehow managed to survive.
Right. So there's a question here in a way about which has priority, right? So you could see solitude simply as the privation of companionship. You could say we are constituted as social beings. We are essentially social, and then solitude takes on its cast according to that backdrop. But Levinas is going to, he's not going to make either solitude or collectivity ontologically prior. They're sort of both basic ontological categories.
And we should refresh what this talk of ontological means here, right? Ontological has to do with metaphysics generally, what types of beings exist. But as Heidegger did ontology, following phenomenology, it's general types of being that you get, however it is that you examine experience. This is the thing that Seth and I were just arguing about a little bit, is that is phenomenology as Husserl invented it a matter of just sitting back and looking at your experience, or is it a more circumspect matter of telling stories retrospectively about your experience?
Very simply, yeah, ontology has to do with categories of being. So Aristotle, quantity is a category and quality is a category. When we talk about the number of things, we're talking about a different type of being than we talk about when we're talking about something being red, for instance, having a certain quality. And you can expand your ontology. It's kind of weird to think of this as ontological, right? And he says this right up front, because when we're talking about solitude and collectivity, we sound like we're talking about psychology or sociology or anthropology, And he warns us against that. He wants us to think of these things not in those typical ways of thinking about them, but thinking about them as fundamental categories of being. So this would, in a way, be prior to everything that we know empirically. It would somehow go to the bedrock underneath all these empirical concepts, the anthropological, for instance. So think of quality and quantity, that example, but now we're going to sort of extend that to this quasi-social realm, the being of human beings, which Heidegger, of course, got us there.
And I think this is talking about ontology in terms of whatever it is that you're getting through phenomenology or these stories that you tell. I think hermeneutic is the right word to give it to it. If you're not sitting and describing your experience right now, if you're describing it retrospectively, if you're giving larger stories that you couldn't actually get from the first person point of view, then I think that is a matter of hermeneutics.
The methodology wise, if we're not going to do phenomenology, it's unclear to me what the ontologist does exactly.
Well, he says later he's getting at the significance of these things. So that's ultimately what ontology boils down to, is the fundamental significance of these phenomena to us. And that really follows the Copernican revolution, following Kant, the describing everything in terms of its relationship to self. And this, you know, he's going to have very Kantian things to say about the things that we think that we see in science or in encountering food or really anything in our environment, that they ultimately refer back to us. So it's all very Kantian, broadly speaking, in this way, that when we're describing fundamental categories of being in the universe, we are fundamentally describing
the structure of our own experience. And that's,
yes.
And if you think about what Aristotle or Kant does when they're saying, hey, what are the basic types of things in the world? They will start thinking about their various sorts of experiences and then slicing and dicing. So that's what the ontologist does.
I want to make a throwback to the last episode. So first off, Mark, I would say that when you say that the point of doing ontology is to get at the significance of something, I'm not sure. That might be something specifically Levinasian and not, if you use the term meaning, get at the meaning of things. He has a very structured way of speaking about those things. But if we talk about our previous episode where Levinas made a big point about taking the Husserlian approach of intentionality, that subjectivity, which is our way of being in the world as human beings, we're subjects, means taking the world and others as objects in this intentional relationship, which by being a knowing subject, which takes things as its object, you, in essence, make that object, which is other to you, which is different than you, it's external to you, into something that's identical to you. It becomes your idea, or it somehow, through the process of you being conscious of or conscious that, you internalize and you make identical and erase the difference in the exteriority of the other thing. That process is what he means when he says solitude. So solitude as an ontological category means the experience of Dasein in the world as a knowing subject or as a subject that creates meaning.
Yeah, I think you're right. He ties solitude to this idea of mastery, mastery over existence, so objects or substantive things. So once we get to the point where we are interacting in that way with the world, why, that's solitude. He starts off with the solitude of existing section, right? Which we get this distinction early on between the existing and the existent, and where the existing is a verb. We're not meant to think of things when we think of existing. We're meant to think about a mode of being, whereas with existence, we're supposed to think in the beginning about things, and ultimately the subject will also be an existent in its own right.
At one point he says he's talking about the same distinction that Heidegger was talking about in contrasting being, large B, with beings. So I don't know if you can even say existing is a mode of being. It's just, it is being. It's the same thing.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, he does use that language, I think, at some point, the mode of being language. We might come across that. So when we're talking about existing, it turns out that that's more like nothingness. It's a category that sort of transcends actually being and nothingness. So existing is the same sort of thing as the there is, which we get some of that in this essay and then in the other essay we read, which is sort of what you get when you imagine the entire world destroyed. You get this, what he calls an atmospheric density or a field of forces. So it's like trying to go through that thought experiment of imagining nothing, but the nothingness is always a something of a sort, but more like a field. there's no things in it, there's no existence, but existing is this sort of field. And the way he begins the essay is he talks about solitude as this indissoluble unity between the existent and its work of existing. Instead of saying that solitude is something like this privation from being cast off, being away from community, solitude lies at the very essence of existing, because existing is this non-transitive, non-relational thing, he calls it, right? Remember when he calls it intransitive, non-intentional, non-relational? In our existing, we are not related to anything. It is inherently isolating. He calls us monads.
Let's just read the quote. In what does the acuity of solitude consist? Which it's interesting to start that, because it sounds like I'm going to be addressing the kind of solitude that you worry about. It's acute. It's something that bothers existentialists when they moan about how everybody is so separated from everybody else. This is not just going to be a technical term. This is going to be him addressing something in your everyday human experience. It is banal to say that we never exist in the singular. We are surrounded by beings and things with which we maintain relationships. Through sight, touch, sympathy, and cooperative work, we are with others. All these relationships are transitive. I touch an object, I see the other. But I am not the other. I am all alone. It is thus the being in me, the fact that I exist, my existing, that constitutes the absolutely intransitive element, something without intentionality or relationship. One can exchange everything between beings except existing.
Which is a great line. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if it's true. I seem to think like you could,
what?
There's lots of other things you could not exchange between beings.
Like what?
Like your colors. I mean, what? I don't know. Everyday things. Can I exchange between my foot and my hand, you know, their shapes, so that my hand becomes foot shaped? The way he's saying it flat out is not true, but I get the point.
Well, your properties as an object are available to other people, right? They're visible parts of the world. People can have a relationship to the shape of your hands.
I mean, you can say
you are
tall like me, you're male like me, you're white like me, you're an American like me, but you can't say you are me like me.
Well, you exist like me. You can exchange everything except existing.
You're not my existence.
My existing, yeah.
My existing.
So one of the things he argues against is the reason that we think there's this solitude is just because of this brute fact of existence. It's not because each one of us has an inner life that other people cannot grasp, which seems to be the more familiar existential dilemma. You know, I've got my pain, I've got my anguish, I've got my own sense of my own death. And even though you might also have pain and anguish and a sense of your own death, you can't have my pain. You can't see my pain. I can't really express my pain to you. So that creates a separability between us. There are many things I could not exchange with you if I can't actually talk about those kinds of things, except indirectly. If there are so many things that philosophy as language cannot get at. But he's saying, no, well, those are all kind of after the fact.
Yes, this gets down again to a more basic level.
Yeah,
it's exactly the same sort of idea in a way, but it gets us at a lower level than subjectivity.
Yep. To be isolated by existing. Mm. It is by existing that I am without windows and doors, and not by some content in me that would be incommunicable. If it is incommunicable, it's because it is rooted in my being, which is what is most private in me.
Yeah, well, he's giving something that in a way explains the privateness of thoughts. We're not just stuck with the privateness of thoughts and feelings as a brute fact. And the reason is this idea of existing and its very tight relationship to the existent.
I want to keep reading because I think this is worth pursuing on the next page. And to the extent that the experience of participation may be real today, it coincides with ecstatic fusion. We need to flesh that out in a second. It does not sufficiently maintain the duality of terms. If we leave monadology, we arrive at monism. Existing resists every relationship and multiplicity. It concerns no one other than the existent. Solitude, therefore, appears neither as the factual isolation of a Robinson Crusoe, nor as the incommunicability of a content of consciousness, but as the indissoluble unity between the existent and its work of existing. To take up the existing in the existent is to enclose it within unity and to let Parmenides escape every parricide his descendants would be tempted to commit against him. Another great, great line.
Shout out to the sophist.
Yep. So existing is the specific and not unique, but own work of the existent. This is all reaching back towards Heidegger and Heidegger's notion of ownness and a kind of authenticity. But each one of us as an existent, as a thing, has as our being in the world, existing, and that existing is the work that we do to become an existent. In other words, to be able to say, sorry, I'm trying to find a way to...
No, this is right, but it sounds so much, he even says like, hey, I'm not dramatizing a tautology, but it sure sounds like in the way you're describing it.
And also, it'll turn out that existing in a way is prior to existence. They're monads that sort of appear like stars in the void, ruptures in the fabric of existing.
Yes. To be an existent, which is to say to be a thing, is to be doing the work of existing, a work that only you can do, so to speak. That's what it means to be a thing, to be an existent. And that's what he means when he's talking about solitude, is that to be something rather than nothing is to do the work of existing. And that's work that only you can do. And there's this sort of, like you said, tautological relationship where if you become a thing out of this vast, undifferentiated existing, the ilia that there is, then you are carving out a piece of solitude, or you're carving out something for yourself. And that in itself is solitude. And he's trying to make the point that that's the starting point, and the very ontological fact of being a particular something against this vast, undifferentiated existing is the act of turning inward and becoming, I keep wanting to say unique, but that's not the word I'm looking for, to become this solitude monad, as he says.
The structure of this, in a way, it's a story about this poor little monad who's going to try to escape his or her isolation. His or her, is it gendered at this point? It's isolation, and is going to keep failing. The solitude is going to kind of be reaffirmed at every step. So the way he ends this section, he says, to conceive a situation wherein solitude is overcome is to test the very principle of the tie between the existent and its existing. It is to move toward an ontological event wherein the existent contracts existence. So the contracting would be a new sort of relationship, and that's going to be what he calls hypostasis.
Hypostasis.
Is it hypostasis?
I looked it up.
Okay, good. All right.
No, I'm going to continue to say hypostasis because I prefer the way it sounds.
Well, I'm going to say it Mark's way. So the hypostasis, you know, later on he will sort of use this idea of a rent in the fabric, but one that's immediately rejoined. So it's almost like a seam, like something that's torn and then seamed back together. And the I or the ego will sort of be that border between the existing and the existent. I know I'm jumping ahead here, but just to give some context to hypostasis, you know, hypostasis in a sense, very literally, is where we get things. The somethings sort of now appear. But at a technical level, he's going to talk about how we get what we would call an I or an ego.
All right, before we continue that thought, let's stop and talk about our sponsors.
We'd like to welcome Warby Parker.
Who is this Warby Parker, and how can he help us understand Levinas?
We've been talking about the ethical face-to-face encounter with the other in Levinas. Faces have eyes, eyes are the windows to the soul, and sometimes eyes need glasses. When you encounter the other, you don't want some lame or ugly frames blocking the view into your alterity. That would be unethical.
Nice.
Fortunately, Warby Parker makes high-quality, stylish frames for prescription glasses that you can buy online risk-free. Their prescription glasses start at only $95, including the prescription lenses. At that price, you can get multiple pairs every season. But what's awesome about the way Warby Parker does things is their home try-on program. You order 5 pairs of glasses that are shipped directly to your door. You try them on when and where it is convenient for you, and you can get feedback from trusted advisors. Now, in my case, that advisor is my fashion consultant, aka my wife. With Warby Parker, I selected my 5 pairs online at my convenience, had her review the selections at her convenience, got them shipped, tried them on for her in person, and had a selection in a matter of minutes, and I never left the house. And it wasn't hard to find 5 pairs to try. Warby Parker's website is super easy to use. They have a large selection of frames in different styles, most with multiple color options. If you wear glasses or are thinking about it, you'll have no trouble finding something you like at Warby Parker. Once you're done with your home try-on, all you have to do is send them back using the free prepaid shipping return label, and you have no obligation to purchase. But if you do want to buy, as soon as you place your order, you'll have them in your hands within 10 business days, usually faster than that. Go ahead and try Warby Parker out for yourself and see how good you look in their frames. Go to www.warbyparker.com/PEL to order your own home try-on kit with free shipping all around. That's www.warbyparker.com/PEL.
All right, and I think we have another sponsor.
Folks, our thing is philosophy, and our domain name is Partially Examined Life. Whatever your thing is, your domain name is important to you. But getting a domain name online can be, frankly, unpleasant. Hover makes it better. Hover helps you take care of your domains and then gets out of the way so you can get on to whatever's next. Now, if you've ever had the experience of getting a domain, then you probably know what it's like to buy a used car. You think you're ready to sign for the car, and you get held hostage in the manager's office to consider the extended warranty and undercoating. With most domain services, you think you're ready to get your awesome name, only to have 40 more clicks through checkout, forcing you to turn down confusing hosting, design, and other options. Hover makes the process better by only offering domains and email, so you can focus on finding a great domain name and getting back to working on your great idea. And unlike most other domain providers, Hover includes free Whois privacy with all supported domains to keep your information confidential. So go find a domain name for your idea. Go to hover.com and use promo code REASON, R-E-A-S-O-N, at checkout to save 10% off your first purchase. That's hover.com, promo code REASON.
Hi all, Brian Wilson here with an update on our September Not School program. Yours truly will be leading another seminar in our Intro to Philosophy series on Plato's Symposium on Monday, September 12th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our opening question can probably best be summed up by Tina Turner's critical analysis on love. What does love have to do with it, and is love a secondhand emotion? We'll be digging into the different types of love, if that's actually a thing, or it's just what you talk about when you're getting drunk and there's a lot of sexual tension between you and Alcibiades, and try to go further than Tina, if possible, and tease out answers to super easy questions like, is Father Zosima correct when he says, love in action is a harsh and dreadful thing compared to love in dreams? Is Rosalind correct when she says, love is merely a madness, and I tell you deserves as well a dark house and a whip as madmen do? Or Hegel's summation of love. Love is a most monstrous contradiction. It defies understanding. To love is to give what one does not have and to receive that over which one has no power. To love is to freely negate the stubbornness that is the self and to live in loyalty to an affirmation that can dissolve like morning mist with the first experience of betrayal. To participate in this seminar or organize your own, you simply have to become a PEL citizen, meaning pay $5 a month, $5 being a crazily low rate to pay for this kind of personal interaction and instruction. And of course, it also includes full-length, ad-free versions of the entire PEL podcast back catalog. If you have any questions, you can reach out to me at brian@partiallyexaminedlife.com. Hope to see you at a seminar soon.
Thanks, Brian. I also wanted to announce a live event. October 27th at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be doing a live Partially Examined Life episode at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island on The Problem with Democracy, talking about Alexis de Tocqueville. We'll give you more information on that over the coming weeks, but just want to throw that out to you so you can mark that on your calendars if you want to drive there or fly out there and meet us or watch the live stream as we have it. All right, so let's go back to the discussion of Levinas.
Now, when we say that to be an individual thing at all is to engage in this hypostasis, are we really just talking about the individual doing the phenomenology reflecting on his or her own ego? We're not talking about what makes this book an individual thing as opposed to merely part of the background noise that involves some hypostasis, right? We don't...
Yeah, only a subject. The hypostasis is what leads to the subject. Yeah.
So it's not that we're defining what existence is in general and saying, well, I exist and this book exists and blah, blah, blah. These things all exist and this is what existing is. It's really more like, what is the being of Dasein? It's like Heidegger's question. What is the existence of beings like us that can do this kind of reflection?
Right. I don't know if he would say that everything, even non-subjects, have this, what he calls this relationship between the existent and the existing. But once we get to the point where we alter that relationship, right? So we're loosening up that relationship now. That's the next step. The indissoluble unity between the existent and its work of existing. To get a subject, you have to loosen that up, or the way he puts it, test the very principle of the tie. The hypostasis loosens up that relationship and turns it into this contracting that he talks about. It'll become more obvious, I think, as we go on.
I find it useful to reflect on, is this supposed to be something that would just be about people, or would this be something that would work? You know, you could talk about incomplete versions of this and talk about, like, you know, a mouse's consciousness, because he does talk about the vigilance of undifferentiated being, which we don't have to jump to that yet if you had something in between.
Okay, let me circle back on this for a second. So Heidegger definitely didn't think that animals and plants and all that stuff had the being that Dasein is something unique. And Levinas, he's Jewish. He's got a lot of biblical stuff going on. I don't see any animal liberation stuff in this work either, so I'm assuming that. But I'm concerned about what you guys were just talking about with hypostasis. So earlier on, we didn't mention this in text, but Levinas says, look, we want to transcend solitude. Solitude is our existence. How do we transcend solitude? One path we could take is knowledge. And that's where we as subjects take objects and we incorporate them into ourselves. We make what's different identical. That's not going to get us there. And then he says, then there's ecstasis, which is where instead of the object being incorporated into the subject gets incorporated into the object. That's the St. John of the Cross mystical union with God kind of a thing. And he says, both of these result in disappearance of the other. And I thought what he was saying was the event where the existent contracts existence, that hypostasis or hypostasis is an event where we can transcend solitude because it does not result in the disappearance of the other into the same, like it does with knowledge or ecstasis.
Yeah, I think there's a whole section on hypostasis as well, which is going to be pretty clear there that that involves solitude as well. You know, again, we're in this story where we're trying to find out how to be with others, how to be more than solitary. And at the point of this hypostasis, I don't think we've gotten yet to attempts to get beyond ourselves, say with knowledge, which doesn't work. But I mean, ultimately, it will be the erotic, right, where we can finally get that relationship, where we can actually transcend our solitude without being swallowed up in the other or having the other swallow us up. But I think this next section, the existing without existence, will set the stage with this sort of field, the force field of the there is, and then the hypostasis section will say exactly what he means by that.
Okay.
Now, is hypostasis where an existent becomes individuated, or is it where an existent transcends its individuation?
I think it's the latter, but we should probably get there.
I think it comes down to what that word contracts, which the existent contracts its existing.
Yeah, well, we have a whole section that we could look at to say what it is. We could say what the there is first and then get at hypostasis as what comes out of that.
So. Yeah, all right. So I'm reading page 44. We return again to Heidegger. One cannot ignore his distinction, which I have already used, between sein and seiendes, being and being, capital B and small b, but which for reasons of euphony I prefer to render as existing and existent, without ascribing a specifically existentialist meaning to these terms. Heidegger distinguishes subjects and objects, the beings that are, existents, from their very work of being. The first are expressed by substantived or substantivated participles, which is to say substantives.
They are things.
Things. The other by a verb. The most profound thing about being in time for me is this Heideggerian distinction. But in Heidegger, there is a distinction, not a separation. Existing is always grasped in the existent. And for the existent, that is a human being, the Heideggerian term, je Meinigkeit, precisely expresses the fact that existing is always possessed by someone. Je Meinigkeit means ownness.
Or mindness.
Yeah. So we have beings that are things. We have capital B being, which is a verb. And beings, particularly the being that is Dasein, that is human being, grasps being, capital B, the undifferentiated verb, right, through its own existence, through its being. So you do not grasp capital B being in itself like an object. You get to it through your own being as a individual, individuated human being.
Then he moves on to the idea of thrownness or abandonment. He's going to associate thrownness with this existing, as in we are sort of thrown into this world that is independent of us and that can't be mastered by us. And he says this gives us an idea of existing without a subject and existing without existence. And so that existing without existence is going to be what he calls...
I would recommend we go with Seth's pronunciation, existing without existence. Because otherwise, existence and existence, there's C-E and T-S, there's no way of distinguishing them.
Okay. So I'm going to just say without things. I'm going to... existence, I'm going to call things. So
that
so an existing without things. And he does use the word something a lot as well, actually, instead of existent. And then he gives us that account of, to think about the there is. We can think about the imaginary destruction of everything and then the sort of atmospheric density, the force field that's left over afterward. And then he calls this an anonymous irremissibility of pure existing. He warns us this is not an indeterminate ground, by which I think he means the manifold, that's already a something, that's already a thing. But it's this work of existing. It's purely verbal, purely non-substantive. And then he gives us this whole metaphor of, for understanding that there is, of insomnia or vigilance without end. And the way to think about this is this kind of horrible idea that even if we killed ourselves, there isn't any way to escape existing exactly. We could, even if we annihilate ourselves, there's always some... I don't know. I'm going to use another metaphor here. It's like this sort of background noise of existing that goes on. We can't really fully accomplish the job. There's no recourse to sleep is another way of putting it. And we saw in the There Is essay, instead of fearing death per se, instead of fearing the nothingness of that, ironically, to Levinas, what we fear is that we can actually get nothingness. We can't put an end to things. We are stuck in this sort of insomnia, this vigilance without end, which is the there is.
I had a really hard time with that section, the vigilance and the insomnia. So let me try to rewind and walk through how I understood it. One of the things that Levinas says here, it's on page 45, is one must understand Geworfenheit as the fact of being thrown in existence. It is as if the existent appeared only in an existence that precedes it, as though existence were independent of the existent, and that the existent finds itself thrown there and could never become master of existence. So he's essentially buying into this idea that we have this experience of ourselves as beings, of being thrown into the world, thrown into existence, and it creates a certain sense of unease because at the periphery of our consciousness or in the back of our mind, whatever metaphor you want to use for that, we have this awareness that there is something which is something that we can never, quote unquote, master. Well, what does that mean? There's something out there that preceded us that we cannot take as an object. We cannot master through knowledge. We cannot control. We cannot.
It's the formative forces, right? Before we get here, there's a whole world out there, and those forces shape who we are. They determine who we become. The person I am is dependent on this whole world of existing people and things that I'm thrown into.
This is the next sentence after. Thus dawns the idea of an existing that occurs without us, without a subject, an existing without existence.
Right. So we start with the concept of thrownness, where I imagine the world without me, without my particular subjectivity. That's been there for millennia. And now I come into it and I am like a leaf that falls into that river. But then I can go farther. I can imagine the world deprived of all subjectivities, not just my own subjectivity. This is one of the few ways here in which he's working us towards this idea of the nothingness of the there is. So it's like the thrownness, but it's the thrownness devoid of all subjectivities. There's never been any people in the world.
Yeah. Right. Let's not say nothingness. Let's say undifferentiated.
Well, it's not technically nothingness.
As we learned from Hegel, it's neither nothingness nor somethingness if it's not determinate.
No, it transcends both of those categories, but it is what we would typically think of imaginatively as nothingness, what's left over after everything is annihilated.
Yeah, but I think what he's trying to say is this is trying to get back to this notion that we're still methodologically being phenomenological, that there's something in our experience that points us to try to consider this. We could conceivably have an experience such that we don't imagine ourselves as being thrown. We don't imagine an existing prior to our existence. This is kind of part of the point he's getting at. But he's saying there is something in our experience of ourselves in the world which gives us unease, which makes us pause and not think that we can be masters of the universe and control all things. Right. Ultimately, this is going to be part of this discussion about death and finitude and all that. But I think he's trying to give credence to that phenomenological move, only where Heidegger interprets it one way, he's interpreting it another way. So I think we're agreeing, Wes.
Yeah. And this is really setting the stage. So the hypostasis is like the subject appearing within the there is. It's star formation. And he'll say that in this section, he'll say something to the effect that the hypostasis is produced in the there is. Let me see if I can find that. Unless you want to talk some more about some of these various metaphors he uses for the there is. I don't know if atmospheric density and all that, I mean, I've mentioned a few times that if you guys think that's helpful, or the vigilance, if you have a better way to explain this to listeners.
I didn't have ready notes on the article from last time. I recall that was much more vivid in just talking about as horror, that one of the images he uses of what's scary about the night. The dark is not scary because we imagine what the things might be doing that we can't see, as you might think. It's because the night is undifferentiated, because we can't see it at all, because as if there are no things, no determinate things at all. He thinks that is like what is horrific.
Well, he says it's the horror of being stripped of private existence, which is not death, it's the impossibility of death. It's the universality of existence, even when I'm annihilated. So if you think about a ghost, for instance, or the undead, if you think about the typical horror movie, the horror there is not my fear of death, my fear of ceasing to exist. It's my fear of going on after death, the ghost, the vampire, the zombie. The impossibility of escaping from what he calls an anonymous and uncorruptible existence. The horror in the horror movie is the worry about being awake forever and not being able to do anything about it, but not being awake as a subject, going on in this very, very low level existing, being a part of the force field.
So it's funny that, like, for Spinoza, that's what immortality is, and it's good, you know, that insofar as you participate in reason, it's a very Platonic notion, then you can't actually die because the part of you that is the reasoning part. It's as if reason is this static Parmenidean being, and he's taking kind of exactly that thing, that there's an impersonal part of our subjectivity, my subjectivity in particular, that subjectivity itself exists maybe in some sense prior to all this, the eternal vigilance. I thought about Chalmers' idea of proto-consciousness, that sort of from any point of view in the world, there is a point of view. And so you could imagine, like, you know, I know that this book is not conscious, but from that position in space, there is a view upon the rest of what's in front of it, but it is eternally vigilant. It is not actually conscious, because he says what would make it conscious, and mice would have this too, incidentally, is the ability to filter out things, the ability to turn off, to turn and look at something else, to go to sleep, to disrupt that constancy. And that's what becoming an individual actual perceiver who's conscious means, that there's motility within this field of potential uber consciousness. Instead of thinking of that as God and a wonderful thing, thinking of that as a H.P. Lovecraft kind of horrific anti-world.
Yeah, so the contrast here is with subjectivity or consciousness. So on at the top of page 50, that's where he'll say, this existing without existence or things, which I call the there is the place where hypostasis will be produced. And then he goes on to talk about consciousness as a sort of tearing away from the there is, a tearing away from the vigilance. And he says something like, the feat of the ego is to be able to leave the situation of impersonal vigilance. So he gives this very ironic description of consciousness, because we think of consciousness typically as alertness or having an ego as being awoken. But for him, quote unquote, consciousness is the power to sleep. Consciousness is the breaking away from the eternal vigilance of the there is.
Yeah, the there is a without self.
Right. So I think that sets us up for the actual hypostasis section, unless we want to...
Well, so, but on page 49, he has one right after the without self part. The existing is not an in itself, which is already peace. It is precisely the absence of all self, a without self. So I'm not Hegel, he's saying there. One can also characterize existing by the notion of eternity, since existing without existence is without a starting point. An eternal subject is a contradictio in adjecto, for a subject is already a beginning. The eternal subject not only cannot begin anything outside itself, it is impossible in itself. For as a subject, it would have to be a beginning and exclude eternity. So any notion of a personal God, right there. I mean, even though he's a Jew, so he's got to have a kind of a Spinozic God, whatever this, you know, we're not going to talk about God today. But given that he describes, in retrospect, this whole thing as being something about our relationship to God, our relationship to authentic eternity, God's not going to be an eternal subject.
No, because subjectivity is right. Pure activity, pure verb. Subjectivity is substantive. You can't have an internal subject or subjectivity at all because subjectivity is substantive, and it is the hypostasis out of the eternity, out of this verb, this activity that has no subjectivity, that has no substantive form. There's another nice little piece after that where he talks about he prefers Heraclitus to Parmenides and the cradleless version of Heraclitus. Anyway, folks, if you're listening, look at page 49.
All right, I'll just read the first paragraph of the hypostasis section to get us started. Consciousness is a rupture of the anonymous vigilance of the there is. It is already hypostasis. It refers to a situation where an existent is put in touch with its existing. So, and I think back again to that word contracting, as opposed to that tight relationship that he was talking about, the indissoluble unity, that unity now has to be ruptured with hypostasis. So the existent is put in touch with its existing.
So that makes it sound like that books and things can exist. They can be individuals, but they're not in touch with their existence. They have not undergone hypostasis.
That's what I took it to be, but...
Okay. I was thinking hypostasis was what existence is at all, that there are no individuals without hypostasis, but it sounds...
I thought this was more like subjectivity. He says consciousness is a rupture, mm-hmm. Not thingness or existence is not the rupture. It's consciousness.
But could you have... things without consciousness? It seems not. Or at least if you take a Kantian take, which I think he's taking on this whole thing, that it's human minds, or at least minds of some sort, that break the there is into existence. Well, let's put that aside.
Yeah.
Because again, he's talking about first person point of view throughout this.
Okay.
He's concerned with the self. So it's bugging me recurrently that I can't exactly figure out what he says about books. But he's not talking about that.
Hey man, books are people too. So now we get to this concept of mastery. So in a way, for the existent to be put in touch with its existing is to now, in a way, to master that existing as an attribute, he says. This is at the top of 52. So you have a subject who is a master of existing as an attribute. Existing is its own, and it is precisely through the mastery, whose limits we shall soon see, through the jealous and unshared mastery over existing, that the existent is alone. So this is where we see solitude sort of crop back up. To have company, to get collectivity, we are going to have this hypostasis. We're going to have this rupture. But that doesn't get us there by itself. In fact, the hypostasis is another relationship that accentuates our solitude. And that's the solitude part of it is that our consciousness is this cognitive relationship with things at this stage. Mastery over things.
Are you on top 52, right?
Yeah.
And it seems like if we are master over these things that are the contents of our consciousness, then the things are not themselves existence. We are the existence.
No, exactly. In order for there to be an existent in this anonymous existing, it is necessary that a departure from the self and a return to self, that is, that the very work of identity become possible.
Yes. So hypostasis is a necessary part of being an existent at all. It's not an extra thing that special existence we who have some self-consciousness gain.
Right.
It is just what it is to exist, is to be hypostatized. Am I not just repeating what you just said?
The main point is we still don't know what books are.
Where they fit in the scheme. Sorry.
There's only people in this world. Or
because the books are all me.
Yeah.
So he is contrasting this to reflect back on Heidegger. With Heidegger and Husserl had this notion that our fundamental relationship to other people is that we are in a shared world. That when I look and I see something as a book, I see it as a creation that somebody else made. And so it's not that I then deduce from that that there are other people in the world. There's no deducing going on. It's just a matter of that's the world that we live in, is a social world. But that's compatible with not having any sort of primordial face-to-face contact with the other at all. It's as if we just see other people through these public things in this shared world. That's what he says that Heidegger's view is. But that was a wandering ahead. So let's go back to 52, 53, somewhere there.
Maybe you should read on after where I just read. More exactly, the appearance of an existent is the very constitution of a mastery, of a freedom. I think that's the first time he's using that now. Of a freedom in an existing that by itself would remain fundamentally anonymous. So with birth of this consciousness through hypostasis, we also get a freedom. In order for there to be an existent in this anonymous existing, it is necessary that a departure from self, okay, and Seth read that part, and a return to self, that is, that the very work of identity become possible. Through its identification, the existent is already closed up upon itself. It is a monad and a solitude.
Okay, you have this undifferentiated anonymous existing. Something erupts out of it that is a thing, although I think more strictly speaking, an existent, which requires not simply being a physical object, right? It's not something that's just produced, because you cannot produce something out of the anonymous existing. We cannot produce matter and suddenly there's matter. And so now there's a rock, you know, now there's an asteroid where there was nothing. What he's saying is that this existent out of this anonymous existing to create something requires a self-recognition, the work of identity, the departure from self and a return to self. There has to be a sense of self, a creation of individuation and difference out of this anonymity. So that's why identity, that's why the subject is a monad and is solitude, is because to differentiate at all from this anonymous existing requires that you make this move to subjectivity, consciousness, where you depart from this anonymous existing as a self and return back to yourself instead of into the anonymous existing. And that's what it means for there to be something rather than nothing, or an existent instead of anonymous existing. So he's saying there's no other departure. There's no other difference. There's no way to become a conscious being or a subject other than to tear yourself away through the act of self-consciousness from this anonymous existing. That's why there's only two ways. There's the anonymous existing or solitude and subjectivity. Those are the only two options.
Yeah, we should keep in mind here that there's a sense in which this is solitude 2.0, because we started with the solitude of the indissoluble unity between the existent and existing, the fact that existing is non-transitive, non-relational. Now, I think the solitude has something to do with not an indissoluble unity, but now they're ruptured, they're right, it's a contracted relationship, but now it's a relationship of mastery, right? The existent as the sort of mastery over existing as a property, as an attribute. I don't know if we can say more by why solitude is implicated in that. I think if we're thinking about what we mean by mastery in day-to-day life, you know, we're thinking about our mastery over objects or activities. It's not a relationship to another human being, in other words. But at this level, I don't know if either of you have anything to say what it why this new relationship to the existing, this mastery relationship, is inevitably a solitude.
Well, I'm still just having the trouble that I did not originally read this, that there is solitude 1.0 and solitude 2.0, but that he was earlier on just summing up his view, and here he's actually giving the nuts and bolts of what solitude amounts to.
I'm with Mark on that one.
Definitely within the dynamic of solitude, as you just pointed out, Wes, there is this indissoluble unity, but then it looks like we get some kind of duality where, as we're going to see, we're in knowledge and in other relationships with the supposedly outside world, that he still thinks that we remain in solitude, that we are reflected back to ourselves, but there's something indirect there. So the dynamic of consciousness involves a longer and longer trip out from ourselves to get absorbed in something else. Like when we're eating, I'm not absorbed in thinking about myself when I'm eating. I'm thinking about the food. But then, well, why am I eating? Well, it's ultimately to serve the self. It's some reference to the self.
Right. But we haven't gotten to that point yet.
Yeah. What is consciousness? So the where we stopped is the first time he brings in time, which, remember, this is called time and the other. So this better have something to do with time. The present. And in fact, this is only going to be a little bit of time. It actually is not time. It's the present. Only the present, not the past, not the future. Those, and this very much brought to mind Augustine. Augustine's account of time was that we have the present is the only thing that's real. The future is not yet. The past is no more. So that's kind of phenomenology, how it presents itself. So the present is what consciousness, when you sort of, again, you're doing the Cartesian reflection on your own consciousness, what do you get? You get the present. You don't really get the past. You don't get the future. But you need something else. We need other people to get that. That's what the longer story is going to be. He says the present is the event of hypostasis. The present leaves itself. Better still, it is the departure from self. It is a rip in the infinite, beginningless, and endless fabric of existing. The present rips apart and joins together again. It begins. It is beginning itself. It has a past, but in the form of remembrance. It has a history, but it is not history. And then he says, positing this, hypostasis as a present is still not to introduce time into being. Although giving us the present, we are given neither a stretch of time set within a linear series of duration, nor a point in the series. It is not a matter of a present cut out of a current already constituted time, or of an element of time, but of the function of the present, of the rip that it brings about in the impersonal infinity of existing. It is like an ontological schema.
So we might think of the present sort of right as this sort of border or seam between the past and the future, but mm-hmm. he's discouraging us from thinking of it that way. It actually turns out to be the border or the seam, the rupture between the existing and the existent.
Does that just mean that the fact that we're, this is the way I was thinking of it, that if you're in a Cartesian self-contemplation state, then you are living in the present, you're reflecting on the present, so it is the present that enables you to reflect, to ask the question of being, to ask, what is it for me to exist? Who am I? All these sorts of things. And those are what creates the distinction between if it really the existent and his existence were an indissolvable unity, then that sort of questioning would not be possible. You need the present. You need the space of contemplation to create that distance to ask the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's associating, so what we normally think of as kind of a non-temporal structure to the subject, because, and later on he's going to call it a function, or maybe he already did, Mark, in what you read.
Yeah, right here, a function of the present, yeah.
He's going to call it the present, the function by which existing turns into an existent. Mm-hmm. In other words, he wants us to strongly associate, you know, what we make it think of as subjectivity, which is this sort of split in the existent, this sort of whatever is implied by consciousness, that the present is the thing that reflects that split. There's something inherently temporal about it. I still haven't wrapped my mind around it, but that's not temporal in the sense that we know time as our experience of time, but ontologically temporal, because that's it becomes an important distinction for him.
So. Yeah. Ontologically temporal, because consciousness, which is always consciousness of, which is always subject-object, simultaneity, two things simultaneous, requires the notion of present. For consciousness to work, to be a thing, you must be able to have a notion of a moment where the subject grasps the object or thinks the object or sees the object or touches the object. Two different things need to have some kind of simultaneity in order for conscious. You cannot grasp past, non-being, non-existing. You cannot grasp future, which is non-being, non-temporal, non-existing. You can only grasp what is, in essence, simultaneous with yourself. So the present as an ontological moment means that consciousness needs that for its function. That doesn't mean that we're talking about time, the broad reach of time where you have past, present, and future and all that. He's just saying, out of undifferentiated existing, where there is no sense of time of any sort, when you have existent consciousness, self, self-consciousness, then you have at least some notion of present. Because he's also going to use the terms, right, to talk about consciousness is a re-presentation of things, right? You represent things to yourself. So there's that root word in there as well. That's what he means. He says, this is precisely because the present is a way of accomplishing the starting out from itself.
That's key. I think why the present is so important here is he's associating hypostasis with something coming to start out from itself, the sense in which a consciousness is a beginning, ultimately even autonomous, is no longer simply a billiard ball in the scheme of things. It's not simply a function of the past anymore.
All right, so we've got the beginnings of time on the table. We've got basically what consciousness is insofar as it gives an explanation of it laid out. I think that is a great time for us to be done with part one. When we come back with part two, we'll talk more about how you get actual time. How do you actually transcend solitude and get the full range of time in its rich sense that we know and love? But really, he's going to say that we have to have a better phenomenological description of it than just the timeline that we abstract for the use of scientific purposes. If you want to hear more and don't want to wait a week, just get the citizen version. Go to partiallyexaminedlife.com, sign up, be a PEL citizen. Just cost $5 for the month, and you can get part two right now. Otherwise, we'll see you next time.